It's nearly become a thing now where people go, I meditate for 10 minutes every morning so I can bring clarity and focus and nail my KPIs and goals and just macho kind of nonsense. And then the joke being, well, actually, if you meditated for an hour a day, you wouldn't need to do any of that.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Live Into Your Brilliance podcast, the place where we shine a light on the innate brilliance of human beings and have a lot of fun blowing up illusions that get in the way. Unfortunately, my co-host is not sat beside me this week. He's back in his own abode back in Boston. But welcome as always, brother. How are you?
I'm well, my friend. I'm missing having you next to me in the flesh. It was lots of fun being with you and doing multiple sessions and some wonderful guests. So I'm super excited for those episodes to come out. And equally as excited to welcome our guest today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's do that because I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So today we're joined by Alan Lyons. Alan is the managing partner of Kinch Lyons, which is a group of psychologists, a company in Ireland who are purposefully unlocking the potential of human capital and have done it with a vast array of brands all over the world, many of whom you'd recognize, the likes of Amazon and Tesco and Google, and they do incredible work as an organization. Alan himself is a leadership coach, trainer, keynote speaker. He's a founding member of the coaching psychology within the British Psychological Society, and he's also a professional member of the Irish Institute of Sport. Super excited to have him on the podcast with us. Alan, you are very welcome, sir.
Delighted to be here with you guys. I always, when you read that out, I often go, Jesus, did I write that myself? I must update that. But thank you very much. That's great.
Well, I hope I've not missed off any of your achievements or things that you've accomplished. So if I have, let me know. Well, Alan, listen, we always love to start this podcast in the same place. You know the premise of this, which is shining a light on human brilliance and blowing up illusions. And that's something that I know you're very purposeful about doing in the context of your work and everything else. But we'd love for you to invite you to kind of speak yourself into our audience and kind of tell your story and how you got into here and what are some of the, I guess, any of the major points that you might point to on your journey in the context of what we're talking about.
The big one for me, I started, I suppose, in traditional psychology when you were looking, the classic REM song, Bang and Blame. Everything was about whose fault is it? How big is it? What are your barriers? And even when I started first 15 years ago in the movement from counseling psychology, there were very traditional kind of team development interventions or coaching. And there's still some there, you know, kind of Blake and Mouton, the leadership grid, which I often think should be called the leadership grill. Do you know those ones where you get teams into a week in a hotel, and you build yourself up to be able to take, you know, you turn your back to the team on a flip chart and everybody gives you feedback, but how you're pulling us back, what are your blind spots are, what you're not good at, and you take it because you kind of signed up for this week and you feel you have to take it. And the premise is, you know, okay, that was candor. Come back next week and it's all gone. You come back a bit broken and you're pretending it was okay because you signed up for it. So I was really, this was the world I wanted to get into, and I was going, Jesus, this is something not working here for me. And then the whole shift in my mind was when it came across, well, first of all, solution focus work, which was came from Milwaukee, brief therapy center in Milwaukee. Steve DeShazer and a lady called Inso Kim Berg, who are amazing people. And they set up the brief therapy center in Milwaukee in the 80s, based on the mental research. It come from Milton Erickson, all those great guys. But what they were doing was looking around all different psychotherapies and kind of going, which ones work? Which is that, you know, let's just take a bit of what works from all of it. And that kind of came up with the solution focus, which is really all about dialogue. Like we all, you know, leadership is just a bunch of talk, but not all talk is as useful. And the solution focus talk goes to look at, well, actually, you know, if that's true, then we all talk about things that are in the past, now, and in the future. And if you're being kind of problem focused, the traditional psychology, we think of, you know, the dreaded future, or, you know, the regressful past. And a big shift then, you can get people using language in a way where you're looking at the hopeful future and the resourceful past, it actually brings up much different conversations. So that's what they were doing in the 80s. And at about the same time, psychology was going through a big shift. Big shift in psychology came when they said, you know what? Have we looked at what makes people want to get up in the morning? What makes your life flourish? What gives you a sense of meaning? What you like about yourself? And the science behind that is positive psychology. There's a lot of pop psychology out there. And I think we touched off this before, Al, whereby the pop psychology is big business. They're the, you know, and that's what I like about your, it's the innate brilliance, but getting rid of the noise. You know, it's all about pretending to be somebody else. You know, so you're actually not tapping into what works for you or your innate brilliance. You're pretending to be somebody else. And people buy these little self-help books, you know, you're in the airports and you read them and you're going to go change my life. And then after about 3 weeks of pretending to be somebody else, you kind of go, ah, here, I'm going back to being myself. Just a stick. It's not authentic. It's great. Sounds great. It sells a fortune, but it's not based on any science and it's all about copying. So if it does work, it's a happy coincidence. The nice thing about positive psychology, which can be infused through the work of solution focus, it's actually just trying to get you to be more enthusiastic about who you are so you can do more of it and stretch and expand your world. Now, it doesn't sound as exciting as the offering from pop psychology, but it's a lot more like it's a stick. It's a lot more honest, a lot more authentic. And it's huge around the world now. In Dublin, in Ireland, we've built first in Europe, positive psychology health wing in the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin. So helping people get over serious illnesses using positive psychology techniques.
And Alan, if I may, you know, for the lay listener, and for myself, what is the, you know, if you, what is the essence of the positive psychology or positive health movement? What do you, where, you know, if you think about the world that we sort of explore on this podcast, and I loved what you said, you know, the dreadful future and the regretful past, and we've had guests on the show who are or were practicing psychologists who echo that sentiment. They're like, oh my God, I can't believe that I spent the first 20 years of my professional life, you know, help making people relive the terrible movies that supposedly they were part of and perpetuated those illusions, only to realize that actually you don't need to do any of that. You know, it's about anchoring in your being and anchoring in the present and being very aware. And so, and living from that place of awareness. And so I'm just curious, the world of positive psychology or positive health sciences, what are some of the similarities and parallels with some of the ancient wisdoms or practices that allow people to anchor themselves in that awareness?
This is the one thing people often get wrong with positive psychology is it's not problem phobic. It's not saying, come in, we're ignoring your problems, we're just focusing on the future. It's actually quite problem centric. But it's more interesting of what you're going to do about them and co-creating an awareness of if it wasn't there, what would be going for you, rather than doing a deep dive into a root cause analysis of what caused it. Because actually what you find where humans are involved, if you do a root cause analysis, you'll actually get lots of reasons. You'll never get a root cause. Now, psychotherapists love this because you could be with them for 6 years. It's good business, you know. It's an art. So let's find some problems. And you just create loads of them, you know. Where most people would identify with the positive psychology movement would be emotional intelligence, be aware of your emotions. And emotional intelligence would be considered one of the key components of positive psychology. So often people say, I don't know if I've heard about positive psychology, but they will have heard of emotional intelligence, which is, I mean, they're the same thing, you know. So being able to manage your emotions, being aware of them, don't let them distract you. We use attachment slightly different. So you don't want to get attached to your problems. You want to be able to, you know, not ignore them, but as they say, don't fight. It's like, you know, they're like clouds in the sky. You don't, you know, they'll cover, but you don't want to get, or even thoughts, when they come in, negative thoughts come into your house. You don't invite them in for a cup of tea. You acknowledge them and let them go. In traditional psychology, though, it's about attaching to them so we can understand them. And they actually manifest and they become our storyline. And everything we see, we go, oh, well, that's because, you know? So there's a big shift in, like, if I give you an example from couple counseling, traditionally in couple counseling, first of all, when I came from that world, we used to say, get the couples in sooner rather than later. Because all that happens between the time that they make an appointment to see you is that they're just taking notes about what really irritates them about their partner, which makes sense because they rang up, we're going to sort this out. And your partner is doing the exact same thing about you. They're just taking notes about, you know, you really are. So you actually make them worse. They weren't great. You made the appointment, they're even worse. Now, if you took a traditional approach to that and you go, okay, in they come, what's the root cause? Why are you here? Now, remember, you don't get where humans are involved. You don't get a root cause. When your partner will say something about you and you'll be thinking, well, if you're going there and you'll use something you're keeping in your back pocket and you see them start going backwards and backwards. But where you will see a shift if you use the solution focus vehicle, positive psychology, if you said, okay, in 6 months' time, if things were a little bit better, how would you know? And that's when you see both of their amygdala go calm. You can actually physically look less defensive. And they start to talk about co-creating what you want instead. Your partner might say, well, I suppose the first thing I do when I get home, I won't. And they're co-creating. And that's really powerful. And it's respectful and it's honest. And it's actually a plan for what we want. And it's not ignoring the problem. We're just actually co-creating what life would be like together without that problem and probably be aware of it before. Now, engineers and traditional psychologists find this very tricky because we, you know, the five whys in engineering, we can't move on until we have a root cause. All of that is absolutely correct. And everything I'm talking about can be ignored if you're fixing a washing machine or a fridge. But you can't take that five whys or that root cause approach. I mean, you can, but it won't be as effective to people because it doesn't work the same way because we have emotions. And a lot of the interventions that we would have worked on in organizations from Blake and Mouton, all of those old school things, they work in the premise that there's no emotions or feelings involved and that everybody's the same. No, which we're not. Everybody is different, have different feelings. And it's actually, the positive psychology thing, it's very respectful, but it's also about you becoming more enthusiastic about who you are and how you feel and be able to adapt and, you know, to play to your strengths. Because most people actually, even that's a classic one, don't know what their strengths are. And what I mean by that is that they'll say they do, but actually there could just be areas of competencies. Now, competency is something you're good at, but if you're using emotional intelligence, a real strength in the context of what we talk about is something you're good at, but also makes you feel good. Okay, so it's a competency, but you also get a sense of being the flow working on it. So, and that's where they're married. So they're real strengths. But when you work with senior people, they might end up in front of somebody like me and they say, you know what, I'm not feeling great, but I don't need to talk, unpack work because that's an area where it takes my strengths all day. I'm one of the lucky ones. And then when you inquire, you say, that's very interesting. How do you know you're playing to your strengths there? And a telltale sign is when they say, oh, well, I've always been told that. As well intentioned, but somebody says, hey, that's a strength. And we never question it. We just sleepwalk. We never reflect, oh, that's a strength for me. And off we go. But it may never have been a strength for you. You could have just been working in an area of a competency. And therein lies the problem. You know, so you're looking at the competency and the energy and that flow moment. But then you get energy and flow from doing stuff, but you're not very competent at. They're usually hobbies. You know, which is good fun as well. You're singing in the shower, makes me feel great, sounds horrendous. That's okay too. But it's even becoming more aware of what, see, it's because we're all different, becoming more enthusiastic, aware of who you are and be more reflective. And that's what you're talking about in that mindful moment, you know. You say, what's it, inner brilliance? We say our basic brilliance. We often say as well, everybody's basically good and it's just becoming aware of that. All we do is create layers and often we're not even aware we're doing that, you know.
And in this space, Alan, you know, one of the sort of great practitioners, certainly on this side of the pond, is Patrick Lencioni with his five dysfunctions, and then the working genius. And what you've just mentioned there has, you know, echoes very loudly in my brain with the working genius, where they have those six sort of profiles. And to your point, a lot of us think, oh, well, I'm really good at that because I've been told I'm really good at it. And that's what my competency is. But actually, it's not what makes me happy.
Yeah, there you have it. You know, a lot of people end up, why are you a doctor? Well, especially this side of the pond, I got the points. Not a great reason, you know. And then you get stuck because you've got, I work doing human factors training, the Royal College of Surgeons, and a lot of doctors invest so much energy and time. They feel they can't let their families down. Are indeed investments, so they're stuck in careers they hate. They just have to be good at school so they can do anything. So, that's so they're not playing to their strengths. Patrick Lencioni, five dysfunctions of teams. You know, those models are all great. I'm a big fan of Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits. They're all great frameworks. But the problem with them is that if you're training them, they're very linear. It's as if classroom-based, we must go absence of trust, then we go here, then we go. Well, you know, not really, because we might, you know, that mightn't be an issue for us, the first one. And, you know, so every team is different because it's working with different people in a different context with different emotions. So content from all that stuff is good. But, you know, it's very old school and a bit old fashioned to take time out just to step through these models, you know. And we don't live them either because it's just teach or tell. You know, coaching is great because, as I said, it's two people, especially peer coaching, you know, using maybe content from what you're talking about. But it's in the, we say in solution folks where the action is in the interaction. So that interdependency thing. And what I really, a big bugbear of mine now as well, where back in the day, self-development, when it was, you know, Stephen Covey and all those guys, doing it from, you know, the right reasons about principles and values and how we're all interdependent and we need each other. Now it's very much, if you look at the younger people, my kids, it's self-development seems to be more, you know, it's more about narcissism. I am the greatest. You know, a friend of mine was looking at a podcast the other day, The Ultimate Human. I was going, Jesus, The Ultimate Human. You're here on a special mission. So it's all self-development seems to be, you know, it's all about me. Before in the old days, it was all about, you know, a sense of service, how we're all interdependent. Now, you will get energy, longevity from interdependence. Taking that solo self-development, standing in front of the mirror every day, telling yourself you're the greatest. Because, you know, you really just don't believe it. And that's why you're doing it, you know. So it's very, it seems very singular. And in fact, there's a lovely research on this, which feeds into it, whereby you know that there's a thing in psychology called the Flynn effect, which means that pretty much every generation gets cleverer than the previous. And they know this because they've been measuring it since the First World War. And the Flynn, he just discovered this. So every generation generally gets cleverer. Now, emotional intelligence is an interesting one because the debate's over. If you're going to be successful in the workplace, being aware of your emotions and how they impact you and others, you know, that's the key. However, it you can develop it, but they've seen the research has shown a huge decrease in certain elements since the pandemic. There's scores from time one, time two during the pandemic. And a lot of people, leaders, this is, have got better in key areas, which they've got better since the pandemic in self-regard, sort of higher self-efficacy. They're better in assertiveness at communicating what they want, and they've got higher levels of stress tolerance. So I thought when I first saw that, I went, really? But actually the premise is they got through hell, so now they're more robust. But if you look at those, self-regard, assertiveness, stress tolerance, they're very individual leadership. I'm better at leading myself. But what's dropped and dropped dramatically is awareness and empathy. So people are less empathic of what other people are going through and also aware of it. So we've got very transactional. And then feed into the ultimate humans and all this individual brilliance rather than we're all interconnected. So we're moving away from where the original kind of self-development movement came from. And the likes of the more honest people like Stephen Covey and his cohort, you know, where, you know, it's interdependence, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating, yeah. I mean, I could jump on that all day long. It's just one thing I will say, if you don't mind, Al, is what I see, you know, working with some leadership groups around the world is you see, and it's a really interesting observation about how during the pandemic people have become more resilient, as you say, and so they've lost that sense of empathy. They've lost that sense of awareness for everybody around them. And then you have this dynamic where organizations are saying, no, we really want people to get back together. And then and they come together for 2 days, maybe 3 days, depending on, you know, what the event is. And then it's like these atoms clashing against each other, but then it's chaotic. And it's, and then they can't understand why this dynamic exists where, hey, we've got these cultural values and we've got this strong sense of purpose. Like, why isn't there this cohesion? Why isn't there this commitment and this trust? And the truth of it is, I think exactly what you've just said there is people have lost that ability to connect and develop that operate from a place of empathy and greater awareness. Yeah.
Big time. And it's hard to create psychological safety online or, you know, trust online. We get into, every time we talk, we just get into transactional conversations the minute you come on to Zoom or Teams or whatever, and it's straight into transactions. So there's less of that social sensitivity where you're getting to know each other. less. And sure, the Surgeon Attorney General from the States last year, he got it's affronted. Was it Time or one of the maybe New York Times, whereby he was equating loneliness. He said it's a epidemic in America and Europe, and he was saying, but his research showed that the impact of loneliness on you was the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day physiologically. So that was, you know, that was quite startling, and it was based on research. Christ, so loneliness. You know, we don't connect with each other. Most people are reporting feeling lonely. I think it was 40% of people in America said they're feeling lonely. And lonely makes you feel disconnected. It makes you feel you're not part of something. So we're all very transactional. We're all kind of just kind of individual contractors in the mindset. And humor is a big thing, and joy, which, you know, we realize it's like you know, oxygen. You only notice it's gone when it's not there. But there is humor and joy in getting together with people, which is taken away because of the pandemic. And interesting, one of the measurements, we all know the Gallup engagement survey, have you got somebody you consider a friend and work, all that. But one of the interesting ones they're doing in Queens and Belfast in Ireland, they're looking how to measure loneliness in the workplace now. And one of the items is, have you got somebody that you could share a laugh with during the day? And if you're asked to know, that's an indication. So, you know, you can take things so seriously, you miss things. So it's all, even when we get together, it's very formal. We're not really being ourselves. You know, so everybody's kind of feeling on edge a little. So we're instilling fixed mindset into each other. I'll only say something that I think I'm going to look good. I'm actually not being myself. So it's, you know, it's decreasing the, you know, Amy Edmondson, who came up with the whole idea of psychological safety, has said it was important before the pandemic. But Jesus, it's super important now. We have to be more intentional and deliberate about it more than ever because of the way we're working, you know? So it's important stuff anyway, now more important.
Alan, I'd love to bring you back a little bit, just to something you said when you were talking about the spouse example, and it really caught my ear. You know, when you shift people into kind of looking into that hopeful future, and their feeling state shifts. And it got me to thinking about, like, to what degree do people misinterpret this as an intellectual pursuit? You know, and when we think about people clashing, you know, I notice that people, they seem to get really hung up on needing to answer the question, why? Well, why am I feeling this way? And you're like, well, that's because you're attached to some funky thinking. That's what it is. And if we can shift your attention, you know, there's a possibility for something new and fresh. And when I heard you talk with the spouse example, it felt like the feeling system came much more into play. You were kind of pointing to the, you know, like, hey, the feeling system has got something really fundamental here for you to pay attention to. And I wonder, as a psychologist, how do you balance that interplay between people wanting to make this an intellectual pursuit, and it's about, okay, so I've got to try and swap my thinking. It's about my thinking versus the feeling system being the kind of lead indicator to help you know where you're at and guide you in the moment.
Yeah. Well, there's loads in that. And first of all, it's not, you know, the person is not feeling well. So it's acknowledging it, that, but then it's about looking at progress towards that hopeful future. And less of it being intellectual, we would actually see that conversation and that interaction, that conversation, we say the action is in it, is actually often that's enough. You know, it doesn't have to be a big plan. Often even hearing yourselves out loud, talking about what you want, can actually start the journey. And then it's about the small steps towards that. And I love the way you use hope, because obviously the world around optimism sounds like you have to be optimistic, which is, you know, a lot of the research Martin Seligman's done. But hope, and this is the Dalai Lama has a lovely book of joy he wrote with Archbishop Tutu. It's great. But he talked about hope being more, you know, it's in your gut, you know, whereby optimism is in your head. So it's kind of nearly marrying the optimism and the hopefulness. But as if we give an example from Milton Erickson, an old school psychologist in the 60s, he looked at something called pre-session change, whereby you're coming to see a therapist, you have your problem, and you're very close to your problem, you're thinking about your problem all the time. And remember, we have a negativity bias. That's not a bad thing. We all just have a negativity bias, which has allowed us to evolve to where we are now. It's just not that useful if you want to be able to flourish. You know, so getting rid of that negativity, or even being aware of that negativity bias, so you can think and, you know, act differently. So it's think big, but then act small. And Milton Erickson identified when you ring up, and the receptionist will be trained. So you ring up and you talk about, I want to see a therapist, here's my problems. And the the receptionist is nearly acting as a therapist. But the receptionist would go, well, what do you want instead? The person often hasn't thought about it and definitely had very rarely heard themselves talk out loud. And they go, well, I don't want to be miserable. Okay, and if you weren't miserable, like what are you looking to achieve? And they talk about their life and their hope when they're away from whatever it is to bring them to therapy. And a lot of times you find that when you go in and you meet them for the first session, they go, I actually don't know why I'm here now. I just didn't want to be rude. You know, and that's what they call a pre-session change. And Milton Erickson identified it. So even that, it just shows you the conversation is the intervention. And to hear yourself out loud helps you make sense of things. And when you're lonely and you're not talking or communicating or having these strange conversations, they're not the normal transactional ones, you won't see a shift in your mood or your feelings, you know? So you can literally transform your experience by how you communicate, you know? So, and they were talking about that at the beginning of the pandemic. In the States, there's a lot of people reporting when they caught COVID that they had the same symptoms as post-traumatic stress disorder. So the same symptoms that soldiers coming home from war zones were experiencing. And so the whole thinking was, God, not only does COVID make you sick, but it can give you a mental illness. And then now that we have the proper data on it, it doesn't cause mental illness, but the way we're thinking about it and talking about it, when we actually caught it, we had such a reaction to it, it gave us the same acute anxiety as post-traumatic stress. So words, this is something Freud had a lovely saying, he said words were originally magic. Well, they still are, you know. Dialogue and words are so important to how you feel.
Alan, if I may, just picking up on, pulling on one of the threads there, you spoke about laughter and joy and just having a good crack. I had lunch with my daughter yesterday, Gracie, who is a nurse in Boston. So we met up for lunch and we were having a chat, and she was telling me about her experience on the ward a couple of days ago. And she said it was absolutely crazy. I mean, they had to have, you know, they had security on their ward for 10 hours of that day because they had four patients that were a bit of a handful. She said it was absolute sort of lunacy on the ward. But she said, and I said to her, you know, because I was just curious and I was sort of scratching a bit, and I said, oh, well, how do the other nurses behave and you know, who's sort of stepping up and leading the show there? And she said there are a couple of people who definitely set the example, but she said the interesting thing for her was that two things. On their ward, the nurses go and do things for other nurses without being asked. So she said it's a really interesting dynamic that she's observed, that she's chatted to other nurses on other wards that doesn't happen. So that was special. And she said, and the other thing is we laugh. And she said, and we actually get together, and it could be for a couple of seconds or it could be as a group, and we burst out laughing, and it's like this pressure valve, you know, comes off, and we all look at each other, and instead of bursting into tears, we burst out laughing, and then we go back into the fray.
I you know, that's living. So actually, we mentioned Colorado before we came onto the podcast, because I know your other daughter is there. But actually, what I was doing there a couple of weeks ago was actually attending a conference on applied therapeutic humor, which is a lot of nurses and doctors and psychologists, and it's all about just what you're describing. It doesn't mean, you know, you can take things so seriously you miss things, but you can also humor is a way, it's a coping strategy. And that's what you're describing. But you're describing two coping strategies. The nurses your daughter's working with, they were also interdependent. So they were reaching out, social responsibility, connecting with you, but also using humor as a way of coping, because everything will pass, everything is impermanent. But without humor, we get attached to problems and we build them up, rather than allowing the humor, and it releases endorphins, the right level of dopamine. It helps manage your cortisol levels. So you can, you know, physiologically it's actually helping you. And it's not a juice, it's just, how can you be laughing right now? This is very serious. But it's actually a great way to defuse. And interesting, when I was in Denver in Colorado, like your daughter, a lot of the practitioners were at the front end, you know, front-facing, front-line staff, and they're applying it, you know. We're looking into the research of it, how do you measure it, and they're actually utilizing and applying it. So that is a key. I mean, if they're not doing it intentionally, it's brilliant, but they're actually even, you know, setting it up so they can you can have a space where it's done intentionally and you can have a ways of working around it. So I'm delighted to hear that story. It's great.
Are you seeing that coming into the business world where people are kind of starting to, I guess, like to my mind, it's almost like lighten up a bit, you know, to bring in the light as well as the seriousness. I was just thinking with that example of, you know, people come back into the office, they've not been apart. And I just wonder if sometimes we're so serious about, right, we're back here and we've got to get on our purpose versus like, no, we're here and we can have a good time and get after our purpose.
Yeah. Well, the social connection you come from humor. Now, it's a bit like when they say to your language, not all language is the same, not all humor is the same. You know, so there's affiliates of humor where, you know, I may be making, you know, leading with levity, making light, being comfortable sharing vulnerabilities, bringing humor when there's enough distance to something I wasn't so good at. That instills a great growth mindset within conversations and culture, because that's the reality. We're not all perfect. We don't all know everything. And actually, the old school psychology as well, you stand up there and you pretend you know everything. You know, I view that like the clockwork mindset. You know, if you look at the works behind the clock, it looks very complicated, but you're standing there as a leader as if, well, I know how all this works. Or like being a parent, we're all parents, as if there's some manual and like, you know, I understand it all. But there isn't. Nobody knows everything about anything, and especially not about organizations or leading people. So bringing a bit of levity and vulnerability to that and a bit of fun really will help people to contribute, because you're actually talking about authenticity. Now, it's not about ignoring problems, but it's about noticing and appreciating humorous moments. And when there's enough time and something goes really bad and you're doing a defuse, not in the moment because you're made to that, you'd be too close to it. But when there's enough space, being able to actually relive and retell how you made a mess of something, but in a humorous way, greatly helps your storytelling. And people connect with that because they go, yeah, you know, rather than pretending you're all perfect, et cetera, you know. So it allows that like safety, allows all that good stuff, you know. It's very important.
Yeah, I think the illusion that we know is one of those things that we have to blow up pretty spectacularly is, you know, like we know that 2 + 2 = 4, but when we're thinking about the future or what might happen next, like the reality is we know nothing. We don't really know what's going on. We don't know what's going on in anybody else's head. And I just think that's one of the biggest illusions, is like, if we could just let go of the idea that we know very much at all, my goodness, this could become a bit more fun.
But actually, it's very stressful to pretend you know everything. You know, first of all, you know, because you'll always be let down. You know, so it's a horrible way to lead, that, you know, I'm predicting now. But I mean, loosening up and letting go and seeing what emerges and being open to possibilities. And then you're actually into a wonderful world of awe. You know, then you actually start to notice things, you know, rather than pretending. You know, like, it's the kind of, if I use the analogy, meditation is a great way for infusing everything we're discussing here. But then it's nearly become a thing now where people go, I meditate for 10 minutes every morning so I can bring clarity and focus and nail my KPIs and goals and just get out there and high performance, you know, just macho kind of nonsense. And then the joke being, well, actually, if you meditated for an hour a day, you wouldn't need to do any of that. Rather than having to go out there and conquer the world, you could go out there and walk in the world and actually respect it and appreciate it and see what emerges. And that's where we're shifting towards. And that's the idea of compassionate leadership, where there's awareness and wisdom rather than being all-knowing. You know, people know themselves better than anyone else, you know? So it's about allowing that to come out rather than telling them about themselves, you know, as you just said. You know, like, that's not respect, but that's not honest, and it doesn't work. It's annoying, you know. At the end of the day.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to use that line, but I'm if I may, Alan, just sort of going back to you, because you've sort of breadcrumbed a few hints that you love some of the wisdom of the ancients, and whether it's a Buddhist thread or some of the others. And so I'm just curious about your own journey and what you've explored, what you love borrowing from, and did you kill Buddha along the way? I mean, have you sort of gone there, learned it, and then sort of pushed it aside and carried on with your own thing?
Yeah. Well, your Stoic philosophy, as I think that's, sorry, and you asked me that at the beginning, was a lot of psychology has just wrapped to science, especially positive psychology, around, you know, like, do not let what you can't control interfere what you can. Stephen Covey then would have had that as your circle of influence. You know, so a lot of what we know in philosophy has been applied, and actually Buddhism has been very much linked to positive psychology. The idea of don't get attached to things, the idea that everything is impermanent, the idea that we're all interdependent, the idea of joy and appreciation and kindness is possibly more important than anything. And to have I killed the Buddha, rather than kill the Buddha, I would be a practicing Buddhist. But it's not like Buddhism whereby, or, you know, people, meditation and mindfulness is huge now. What people talk about is, a lot more than they practice it, by the way, as if it's going to the spa, you know, as if it's a holiday and you can relax and, oh, this is my... but that's not meditation. Meditation in the Buddhist way would be, it's hard work. It's mental training. It's like more like bricklayers. And all you do when you finish is go back to square one. You just go, go, go. And that's, you know, and you're back to your bread and being aware. And the compassionate leadership thing that comes from that, I think, is definitely where we're at. And it's, if you will, there's a lovely story by a research that we're trying to say, well, are some people just better at this than others in terms of compassionate leadership? You know, is it a personality thing? You know, cause are people just more, some people are more aware and more wise and they'll do the right thing. So I think it was Daugherty and Bateson, I think, were the two guys. They were sociologists. And what they did was they got, have you heard of the healthy Good Samaritan, you know, the story? They did a thing called the Good Samaritan Experiment, where they got 67 trainee priests, seminarians, and they thought they'd be a good cohort because clearly they're going to be compassionate people, right? So they got 67 of them. They split them randomly in half. And the study or the experiment was they asked half of the group to individually go across the road and will they give a talk on helping a stranger. And for them, that's like, you know, basic maths. You know, it's you're trained to be a seminarian. You got that story. No pressure. There's no anxiety about this one. So they sent them off individually and they told them that they, you know, they're up short. They don't dilly-dally. But when they were on their way to the building to give the talk on always helping a stranger, the Good Samaritan, lo and behold, halfway across, there was a stranger in need. There was a person clearly in pain, clearly needed help, a stranger. It was an actor, obviously, doing the, you know, but all of the priests or training priests there walked past this person because they had to get to the talk about always helping a stranger in need, you know? So, you know, so that was the thing. And then the other half, seminarians as well, the same thing happened, except they gave them a little out. They said, you don't take too much time, but you have a few minutes. So same experiment, they went, there was a poor fella who needed help. Majority of them stopped the help. So what they were saying is, well, then it's not personality-based. All it was about time. You said busyness kills your heart. And it's a bit like you guys said, we're all basically brilliant. We'd say in Buddhism, we all have basic goodness. And it really is, it's about time and reflection. And if you take the time, people will do the right thing. We keep so busy, because none of this is rocket science. You know, anytime you start a course and you go, what does good leadership look like? What does a high-performing team look like? Everybody will get these characteristics. But then why don't you do it? Time, reflection, meditation, practice, awareness. So that's the key. By working on yourself, you're working on other people. So that would be a key driver in my own belief. I would heavily, I might mention Buddhism in organizations, because that might very conjure up various, but the great thing about Buddhism, it's a religion, but it's more of a way of thinking. And it's basically says, what I like about it, I was brought up in Catholicism, where you're made to feel bad about everything. You're born bad and try and recover before you die. In Buddhism, you're born good, don't worry about it, and work it out for yourself. And I went, oh yeah, so there's an intellectual thing, a kind of psychology. But so Buddhism isn't telling you what to do. It's just saying, work it out. Everything's impermanent. Actually, you know, if you get attached to a problem, that problem will make you suffer more. But if you, you know, and you will suffer anyway. But if you get attached also to having a good time, not that that's a bad thing, if it's all you want to do, that will lead to suffering anyway. So it's sitting with it all and being aware of it. So that's huge overlaps. And all we're doing now is applying science to what they've been practicing in Buddhism for centuries. If you look at Daniel Goleman, who popularized emotional intelligence, Richard Davidson, who's done all the research on it, they've all, now they don't put us in there because they're all writing for the Harvard Business Review, but they're all have been heavily influenced by Buddhism. And actually the Dalai Lama himself, who works with all these psychologists, he has a leadership symposium every year, which he looks at the latest in psychology and how it's connected with Buddhism. And he was asked, but what happens if the psychologists find out something that actually refutes what you're teaching in Buddhism? And he said, well, we'll have to change it then. Rather than science, yeah. If the science refutes it, now could you imagine a Catholic church saying that? So a lot more come from there, you know.
Yeah. And it's you know you mentioned we had a guest on the show called Amy Jen Su, who is this remarkable woman, but you know she with a great degree of awareness and fortitude, and born out of her own experience, and her own journey and humbling, has boldly put Buddhism into her work about leadership, and she writes for the Harvard Business Review. It's wonderful to see this coming into the mainstream. And of course, you know, to your point, now it's been appropriated sometimes in the wrong way as this kind of like, no, this is part of my macho regime. I do the meditation. I'm super self-aware, so I can go and smash the world and
me.
But I mean, it's still the arc of this sort of growing awareness and this more this higher level of consciousness, I suppose, is not that steep to start, and if there is a steep part to it, it's because people jump on the bandwagon and then they may fall off along the way.
But they all do, and exactly, because you're over promising and under delivering to yourself. All Buddhism does, and your previous guest is probably, and it's the same in psychology, it's just a way of examining your mind and understanding the nature of your own mind so you can work with it in a really healthy way. That's all it is. And most leaders who are anyway good are doing that anyway. You know, if it works through Buddhism, great. But the practices of Buddhism for mental skills and examining your mind, I haven't found any other practice in psychology that would even come near, you know.
And Alan, in the spirit of practice, like, are there any practices that you personally used that you find particularly useful on a regular basis to allow you to leverage your mind in a positive way? Are there things that you would point to for the listener that they might be saying, oh, this sounds amazing? Like, what are some of the key practices that I may be doing or I may not, that I could get curious about and see what it opens up for me?
Well, there's loads. I mean, my own one would be the meditation, but that's not just on and off. I would do that. And then retreats, which is a big thing. So actually spending, it's, you know, doing your half an hour a day is great. And the neuroscience behind that and what's happening and you're changing, but then actually spending time going to a retreat, and there's loads all over the world, but actually where you don't speak for a week, you know, and you're led to these different practices. I speak a lot and very fast, as you probably know. So when the psychologist would be said, you're not going to speak for how long? They find it very amusing, but it's very, very, you know, it's having a whole, you know, doing it for a week or 2 weeks. It's really, really, you're giving yourself the beginning. Now, it's not easy. You're not going to wait to a spa for a couple of weeks. You're going to wait to sit with yourself. But there's nothing better that I've done than the emotional intelligence training, helping people also by teaching all of these practices. You crystallize your own understanding because you get asked questions, which help a bit like this, help you make sense of what you're thinking. Because, well, then, or else you could just read a book, look at a TED talk. But why doesn't it give you the same experience? Because you're not interacting with it, you know? So it's the action that's always going in the interaction. And it's about finding it for yourself, but giving yourself the time. Remember, busyness kills the heart and the space to do it. There's a really respectful crowd I would like, who are really growing. They're 15 years old now. There's a lovely lama called Mingyur Rinpoche, which is M-I-N-G-Y-U-R, Mingyur Rinpoche, R-I-M-P-O-C-H-E. But he has a group called Tergar, which is T-E-R-G-A-R. And they're a community of practice global now. But Richard Davidson, who I mentioned before, all of those big Harvard guys, they would be involved in the curriculum of all the Tergar training, etc. They'd be, if you're interested in what I've been talking about, that'd be a good starting point to jump onto them. They're really good. And they're global. So you get a practice anywhere in the world. They call them Sangha. Sangha is a community of practice. So you just tap into one. And it's a bit like going to a book club, you know? So it's great fun.
No, thanks for that. It sounds awesome. I'm tempted to dive in, but I think we're kind of might have to come back to this another one. That statement, you've said it twice now. Busyness kills the heart.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that is the number one thing I hear people say. Oh, just so busy. I'm so busy. And yeah, I don't know if you have a nugget on that for people. It's like, what, when you must, if you work with clients, that must come up all the time. Well, Alan, we're just so busy. How do you guide them in that moment?
Yeah, well, it's nearly a badge of honor, isn't it? And that's just so I don't get done for plagiarism. Busyness kills your heart. I think it's Rasmus, his second name has gone for me. He's a Harvard guy as well. He wrote the book Compassionate Leadership. He actually has that chapter called Busyness Kills Your Heart. But I really resonated with it too. That's why I remembered it. But you'll always be busy. And people talk about, oh, I'd love to have the time to do that. This is a luxury. But the reality is, it's the classic important but not urgent. The longer you leave it, it will become an urgency to you. So giving yourself that reflection time before you jump, or even, you know what we call it? It's like, the whole classic Viktor Frankl, you have the stimulus and you have the response, and in the middle, you have the freedom to choose. But even breaking it down a little bit, just give yourself a mindful gap. Before you react to something, go back to your breath, because your mind rests well in your breath. Even just, and even at a business meeting, people will know you're doing it. And you're just creating more mindful gaps, even if it's just a split second. And the more you create mindful gaps, you will respond without the busyness killing your heart. You respond basically how you'd like to respond on a good day, not just reacting in the moment and going, well, look, I'm busy, I can't take. No, because it's a macho thing. But I think that's control and command. But people, because there's only, you just end up exhausted if you're running, because that's high energy. And people think it's high performance. I always drive my car in fifth gear. It's real macho stuff. But actually, elite athletes spend as much time, and this is a good trigger point for them, because I like the comparison with elite athletes. I used to work in London sports economy. They spend as much time reviving and re-energizing, getting better. So you're actually saying to them, as a leader, if you're going to be an elite leader, how do you do that? Where's your reflection? How do you, get better? How do you take time out from the chaos and go back into the whirlwind? So even the high-performance athletes are doing that. You go down, you dip, and then you go back for healthy high performance rather than always on, because what happens with those kind of leaders and people is they're always on, but the off bit is just exhaustion. It's, it's bad relationships, it's crap conversations. It's not a great place to be. Yeah. And they'll resonate with that, because that's the world they're living in.
And that really resonates with me. I'm in 2 weeks' time, I'm actually doing a session for 140 leaders here in Boston, and it's really interesting, because what I've observed, and this is a remarkable group of people, like, I really love them to bits, and I've been working with them for 18 months, and what I find fascinating is when you trot out, and Al and I developed a leadership model when we were working together at Mimecast, and we had our three circles of lead, managing, and coaching, and the epicenter of that, where there was this concentricity, was the self, and so it was at the heart of the Venn, and it was like, you've got to develop this acute sense of self-awareness. And as we became more grounded in what that meant, it was, being able to operate from a place of empathy and love and openness and curiosity, rather than from a place of fear and closed-mindedness. And you trot that out, and people are like, yes, I love that. That's the thing. I'm gonna do that, and then I can be a more effective leader, manager, and coach. And then you do sessions, and you're like, okay, how do you elevate your consciousness? And you get Amy Jen Sue in, and she comes and talks to everybody, and they all read the book, and woohoo! And then the next thing, you're like, what's happening? Why does everybody seem to be operating from here? And the answer is always the same. We don't have time. And it's fascinating to me that, and so I'm really curious about the work that you're doing with teams and corporations, because how do you even when you paint the picture of what positive psychology brings to the table, how do you break the muscle memory of not having enough time?
Yeah, I mean, there's a knowing doing gap. Like, none of what we do is rocket science, right? Everybody looks and goes, yeah, but then it's putting it into practice. And it's a bit like Alcoholic Anonymous or Weight Watchers. It's rarely you're working with my counseling psychology hat on that somebody doesn't really know what to do. You know, that's the easy bit. It's not an aha moment, but it's how you put it into practice. And actually, a lot of it comes from Weight Watchers and kind of your AA support meetings. It's accountability sessions. So peer coaching is a very powerful way. And it's actually, there's evidence coming up that actually executive coaching, which we all obviously, it's big business, what we do. But actually, in a lot of contexts, peer coaching, the research is showing that it's nearly more effective than one-to-one exec coaching. Having accountability partners in work where you're living the experience together and you're holding each other accountable. So you're peer coaching, and that's not just getting together for normal conversations. You're teaching them how to actually peer coach and have coaching conversations like we're having today. But they regularly get together to hold themselves accountable. Because even if you look at somebody's week, and you go to them, it's a bit like saying, I'm going to go to the gym, I'm going to get fit. Okay, well, you know, that's an idea. And within 2 weeks, I'll slip from that. But if I said, okay, you know, from X to Y by when, on Tuesday at 10, on Thursday at 4, and I block it out before my week begins, I'm much more likely to be successful. So when you're working with leaders saying they don't have time, when you look at their week, if this is the most important, it sounds like when you just come off the course, which they're thinking that, but if it's not in their week before their week begins, they're unlikely to be able to, because new habits are hard, right? And they, we have propensities. We just slip into old ones because it's a lot easier because I feel I'm getting somewhere. Because what we're talking about is you spend time in it, but it doesn't give you the same kick. You know, it's like when you first go to the gym, you feel, oh, geez, what am I doing? But the more you do it, you see it benefiting everything else. So it's about that discipline at the beginning. Or Stephen Covey had a lovely thing. He'd call it the big rocks. Before your week begins, what are your big rocks that you're going to put in your calendar? So you're literally mapping with them. Show me your diary or your calendar. And where have you actually put the practice for this into your calendar before the week begins? Now, stuff might happen, but I promise you, if they just start the week and go, ah, yeah, I'll get around to that stuff that I did with the lads sometime, but they won't. And they might the first week, it'll skip the second week. But the third or fourth week, they'll start blaming you, the science or something, but they get frustrated because they know when they were in that session, they really, really enjoyed it, you know, and then they haven't done anything with it. So it's about the discipline of accountability. And it's the same with, if I bring it back to Buddhism, that's why we have sanghas. Sanghas are just communities because it's very easy to move from the path of Buddhism, you know, but the sanghas, the community of practice, helps you hold yourself accountable. If you're an alcoholic, you want to give up drugs, it's very hard, but having that accountability of practice helps because any new behavior or habit is, but we can do the same through peer coaching and organizations.
I love that answer. I think it ties in with what you said before about think big, act small. And it's amazing how often we get caught up in it. It's like, it's going to be amazing. And then we just miss the super simple, practical steps of setting yourself up for success. It's like, we almost have to answer the pre-question, which is, because it's not like, how do I do meditation? Like, I kind of know that, or I've got that. It's like, well, how do I set myself? There's another question that's just missed, isn't it? How do I set myself up for success? What's the simple change that I can put into my system, and then I'll just show up to that? And then we can layer those in. We can add another one in. We can be like, oh, I'll just build on that, which...
Yeah, but I think the key though that I'm hearing, because, you know, like if I go back to Amy Jen Sue, she's got this lovely chapter in her book about process. Like, are you aware of your circadian rhythms? Do you know when when your energies are high, when they're low? Are you a burster? Are you more metronomic? Like, you know, she's very specific about that. But what I'm hearing, and the wisdom that's coming through for me in what you're saying, Alan, is that's all good and well. You can design your process. You can design your personal operating model, to use corporate speak. But if you don't have that accountability partner, if you don't have that peer-to-peer connection, and you don't build that connective tissue where you do have that kind of support as a key element of that operating model, it will fall flat every time. Because we're human, and we get all excited because we've designed a beautiful week for ourselves. But then we're like, I'm going to go and get that other snack from the fridge.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a bit like, the mind over duvet moments the minute you get home. But if you have a gym buddy, accountability buddy, the doorbell goes and you go, oh, Jesus. But, you'll enjoy it. You can't think your way into a way of feeling. You have to behave it. So it's the behaviors I'm going to think, will help you feel and think differently. But it's that accountability. And nobody likes the word accountability because it sounds like discipline. But there's a freedom in that discipline because at least you're operating on, when you sit back, what's most important to you. And you're bringing it in. And also not giving yourself a hard time because, there's all this pressure and nonsense about neuroscience and leadership that they make up. Pop psychologists going, and you just do 21 days, you're changed. You're like, but don't give yourself, do less, and don't give yourself a hard time when you break it. Just being aware of it, and even being aware, give yourself a little smile, a wry smile, and come back at it again. It doesn't have to be perfect. Just being aware, even being aware when you've lost attention to what you meant to do. That is an intervention. That's perfect. Just little steps of awareness. Doesn't have to be a big drama.
Yeah. And you know what? If you're listening to this, this is what's so fascinating for me, listening to this last piece. This is where this whole podcast got born out of, Alan. Just like, it's so interesting for me to listen. Myself and Bill has worked together for 10 years and we would speak every Friday. And I sometimes think we misinterpret what an accountability conversation is or what it's possible to be. Because we were really that for each other. It was talking. How are you doing? How are you doing? Oh, this is what I've uncovered. This is what I've seen. A shared kind of pursuit of something, and a conversation about that is what an accountability conversation is. It's not that Mark turned up and went, "Did you do your homework this week?" And I went, "Well, yeah, I did." Or did
yeah.
It was a loving, powerful conversation, and that's how this got born. I just think sometimes I have a little thing about the word accountability, because I think people think that's about accountability conversations. We're going to make each other do it, and I just think it's when they're really healthy, they're much more of a no. We're going to raise each other up so that we can stay on the path, and so I love that.
Any great group, even if you look at groups like U2, the Rolling Stones, all the great ones are there as accountability partners. There's loads of bands that have way more talent and skill, but they fall apart. But on paper, they're better. Why? Because they don't have that holding each other up, bigging each other up, holding each other accountable. Anybody can get up in the morning and has had a good idea. Very few people follow through. And really good bands, and you notice artists who are, because there's so many bands and artists in many ways who have not reached their potential because of this bit.
What a great place to start to bring this to a close, and like pointing to these great bands and what they teach us. Alan, I don't know if you know, we do have a closing tradition on the podcast, which is to invite our guests. If you could design a bumper sticker for life, what would your bumper sticker say?
Don't take it too seriously.
Lovely.
I hope that is the clip you can put on LinkedIn, because you just see the mischief and the smile in Alan's eye as he said that. And you just know there's a man who knows how to have some fun.
Yeah.
I didn't know you did that, so thanks. I should have prepared.
Well, it's always fun for us when we catch with, and you never know what's going to come through. Yeah. We believe that the wisdom shines through, and there it was. Alan, listen, wanted to thank you for joining us in this conversation. An hour has just literally flown by. It's been super insightful. So many nuggets of wisdom. I think, this for me, I know it got a slightly different source, but that busyness kills the heart. And also, just that pop psychology is pretending. There was a real sense for me of like letting go of that and coming back to the truth. So I've really appreciated all of your sharings today. And so thanks for coming on. Bill, any final words from your side as well?
Yeah, I mean, Alan, this has been amazing, and in the hour or what have you, I've just fallen in love with you, because for a number of reasons. I just love your mischief. And I just wish people could see your face during as you were sort of talking through things, because I can see the just sheer delight. But also selfishly, you know, my daughter who's studying tequila and skiing in Colorado, is also doing psychology, and I know that there's this world of psychology that is a big departure from the traditional models, and is super exciting. And it does have this very positive and slightly irreverent, if I'm honest, approach. And I think it's very exciting. So selfishly, I'm very grateful for this insight, because I'm going to steer her in that direction and point to it, and hopefully she will see something she loves. But apart from that, thank you for your time and thank you for your wonderful wisdom. And my bumper sticker from this session is busyness kills the heart. And I'm gonna point to that profoundly at that session in 2 weeks' time, and I'll let you know how it goes.
I'd love that. Good luck with the session. Great to have this conversation with JP. That's pretty fun. Thank you.
Lovely. And Alan, just one final thing. So if anyone's listened to this and thinks, gosh, I'd like to learn more about this guy, I'd like to maybe connect with you in the context of their company, where should we point them?
So kinchlyons.com, KINCHLYONS, or LinkedIn, Alan Lyons, LinkedIn would be delighted to.
Perfect. Well, listen, we'll put all those in the show notes for anyone listening as well. Alan, thanks again for coming on. Look forward to being in conversation with you again soon. But until then, to everyone listening, keep living into your brilliance and don't take yourself too seriously.
Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us on this enlightening journey, unraveling the innate brilliance within every human being. We hope today's episode has sparked new thoughts and inspired fresh perspectives. Remember, the power to shatter illusions and unleash your true potential lies within you. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite platform. If you'd like more insights and daily doses of inspiration, you can follow me on Instagram at @AlKennyCoaching. Or you can connect with myself and Mark on LinkedIn, where we will share articles and perspectives about unlocking your innate brilliance. Remember, you are capable of extraordinary things. Keep believing, keep exploring, and keep shining brightly. Take care and stay brilliant.